So, first, could you present yourself?
Yeah, my name is Gord Hill from the Kwakiwak Nation, and I'm currently living in Vancouver, BC, occupied Coast Salish territories.
We're in the context to talk about decolonization, and you've been writing a lot of things about that. Can you introduce the subject in your point of view?
Of decolonization?
Yeah.
Well, decolonization, I think, would be the ending of colonialism, the ending of the colonial regime, and the liberation of the indigenous peoples. But I think one thing about that decolonization as a word, it was kind of co-opted by the United Nations after World War II, when there was all these anti-colonial rebellions around the world. And then there came the period of what they called decolonization, which was the forcing out of mostly former European colonial powers out of Africa and Asia, and the taking over by U.S. transnational corporations. And so that whole period is referred to as decolonization, but it was actually the establishment of neocolonialism. So I think the word itself, decolonization, has been somewhat co-opted. And you can also have people who are indigenous people who are promoting decolonization, but actually promoting capitalist development within their territories, because they see that as being a form of economic decolonization. So the word is kind of problematic.
Yeah, because what that point is also that it's not enough to talk about power to indigenous people, because some indigenous people are not working in the sense to decolonize their people.
Yeah, I mean, I think with real liberation, anti-colonial liberation movements, decolonization is a part of it. It's like a political, economic, social, cultural process. But I prefer the term, liberation movement, liberation struggle, rather than a struggle for decolonization. Because liberation implies that you're decolonizing. And decolonization itself, to me, it doesn't directly challenge the capitalist system that we're presently living under.
How the liberation or decolonization root in your reality as a person in struggle?
Well, I think it's important, I think everybody in society has been colonized by the system, by capitalism and Western civilization. So we're all kind of colonized to one degree or another. So things that we do to, like, anti-capitalist resistance itself is a form of decolonizing. And within the anarchist movement is a form of decolonizing. And indigenous people participate in decolonization when they are out on their traditional territories or they're practicing some part of their traditional culture. But I think without that resistance aspect to it, it's easily co-opted, because if you look at how the system manages populations and culture, they can easily incorporate people's culture into their system. So, I mean, in our day-to-day life, we can decolonize by practicing traditional culture, by not buying, corporate products or growing our own food, building our own communities and networks of support and healing. All these things are a form of decolonizing, but they don't in and of themselves lead to decolonization or liberation.
What are the struggles going on you feel are going in the good way to decolonize this colonial world?
I think, right off the bat, I would think of the Mapuche struggle in Chile. I think they're a very strong movement. They're protecting their traditional territory. They seem to have a fairly strong community that's still, living together and fighting together. And, I think they made a lot of strong campaigns over the last few years in that. And, they were never conquered by the Spanish, and they're still fighting with the Chilean state, although the Mapuche territory is in Argentina and Chile. It's very strong in Chile, southern Chile right now. I think that's a strong example of an anti-colonial resistance movement. Here in Canada, it's a different kind of situation in Canada, because we're living in an advanced industrialized nation. A lot of the imperialist lifestyle is kind of accessible to a lot of people here, including indigenous people. So our movements are really easily co-opted in this manner. But, there are some, significant struggles going on right now, like the Unistaden campaign, the Wet'suwet'en, the Unistaden clan to stop the pipeline, the Pacific Trails pipeline, the overall anti-pipeline struggles that are going on here. I mean, these are, important struggles to defend the territory, but they don't necessarily have, an anti-colonial, anti-capitalist analysis behind them. So, our movements here are kind of, a little bit behind, I think, a lot of the what's in the so-called third world.
You've been writing a lot of things about that, as I said, and also you've been starting your own project since a long time called Warrior Publications. some interview that we did also on decolonization with other people, they wasn't mentioning this site. Could you talk about the history of warrior publications?
Sure. I think it was started around, I'm not too sure, it was maybe in the early 2000s when I started publishing zines, just kind of like manuals. I did a decolonization manual, a colonialism and decolonization manual, and then I published some magazines that were just called Warrior. And then the website was established, I think, in 2007. And pretty much maintained it ever since. And it's mostly just try to be like a daily news update of kind of important or inspiring struggles that are going on. And there's different documents on the website that people can download, like about the history of colonialism or about the history of indigenous resistance, counter-surveillance security manual. I mean, the purpose of Warrior Publications is to strengthen indigenous resistance and inspire a warrior culture among indigenous people, and to help maintain solidarity with other anti-colonial resistance groups.
You've been also insisting a lot to fight against pacifism or the orthodoxy of pacifism. Can you talk about why we should fight against that?
Well, I think one aspect of it is because we're living in like a so-called first world country, an advanced industrialized country, the population overall is already kind of pacified because they're living an imperialist lifestyle and they're benefiting from this system to some degree. So the population's already kind of pacified. And the pacifists, the ideological pacifists, come in. They want to impose pacifism on any kind of social movements that arise. So I think that's very problematic, because what we want to do is inspire a fighting spirit amongst our people, inspire a resistance movement that's not just protests, like calling attention to some injustice and hoping that the authorities are going to act on it, because ultimately we have to have the strength and the power within our own movements to change social conditions. So pacifism is a very disarming ideology to have so rigidly imposed by people. And I think that most of them are like middle class organizers who, because of their privileged lifestyle, you know, they're worried about their careers. If you look at the history of pacifism, which only became common in the 20th century with Gandhi and then later Martin Luther King, I mean, you look at them, I mean, they're like privileged elites organizing, mostly middle-class cadres or other organizers, and they're the ones who have the resources to impose this pacifism on the movement. So I think it's something that's really important that needs to be challenged.
You've been talking about a little bit on the history of the concept of decolonization and also the recuperation. Could you talk about the difference that you can perceive between the decolonization or the process of decolonization or the struggles around decolonization here compared to like the era of Frantz Fanon and other Albert Mimi?
Well, I think one big significant difference is like at the time of the anti-colonial liberation movements after World War II, you had the Western European colonial powers were very much weakened by the war. So, you know, Britain, France, Italy, all those countries were weakened by the war. A lot of their infrastructure was destroyed. They couldn't hold on to a lot of their former colonies, which were beginning their big rebellions after World War II. But in that time period, you also had the Cold War, which, you know, there was the split between the capitalist West and the so-called communist East. And a lot of the anti-colonial movements were able to benefit from acquiring resources from one or the other of these two major camps, these blocks that were established after World War II, you know, with the United States leading kind of Western imperialist nations, and then the Soviet Union leading the Eastern Bloc, so-called Eastern Bloc. So I think that's very different conditions because, of course, after 1990, with the collapse of the East Bloc, you had the ascendancy or the rising to the top ruling position unchallenged of the U.S. and its NATO allies. So it's a very different historical time period that we're in now. And the anti-colonial liberation movements were successful after World War II because of the weakened status of the European powers and because they were able to gain these resources from one or the other blocs. So they were successful, but, I mean, they were still contained within this capitalist system. So that's why the United Nations decolonization period was really just the reestablishment primarily for the benefit of U.S. transnational corporations. But now we're in a different historical time period. And now with the global economy, it's kind of reached its peak, and there's nowhere else for it to expand. So now you have these anti-colonial and anti-capitalist resistance movements that now it's kind of a more focused target of what exactly is the system, how can we fight against it now, using our own social movements, our own power as people organizing. So I think as the economy declines and as the Western powers especially begin to decline, just like after World War II, it creates a better condition for anti-colonial and anti-capitalist resistance.
The difference also between Frantz Fanon or other people who've been talking about decolonization a bit in the same sense is also that most of them, including the radical indigenous people here in SoCal, Canada, they're not talking about kicking out everybody, like who is invaders. How do you
see? No, I don't think that's never been a part of the anti-colonial, you know, struggles here. It's more of like making alliances with non-indigenous peoples. Because, I mean, that's like a basic part of the art of war, is like when you have a large enemy camp, you don't want to attack every faction within that camp because you just unite them. So you want to seek allies within the colonial settler society. You want to make allies with them so that you gain their alliance, but you also gain their resources and you take away from the colonial regime, the colonial society. So that's like a basic tactic, I think, or strategy that has kind of been employed by indigenous liberation movements here in North America anyway. There's no strong movement to, like, kick out all non-indigenous people. I don't think that's a possibility. But what you're looking at is, like, a multinational resistance movement that's aimed at anti-colonial, anti-capitalist resistance. And I think, you know, you also have the class aspect of it because, you know, a lot of, like what Frantz Fanon, a lot of that period of anti-colonial liberation movements, they're actually like national liberation movements. And now, with the way conditions are now, I think you're looking more at like a class struggle type of movement. I think that's more of a reality now, because the national liberation movement's mostly successful only because you had the Cold War going on, because you had the East Bloc and the, you know, the Western Bloc, that you could make alliances with one or the other and build the national liberation movements. But I think it's beyond that time now. Like, I don't think it's so much national liberation. I think it's multinational liberation movements is what you, especially here in the context of North America, where there's people from all around the world that have immigrated here now. And it's not the same as like Vietnam, 1960s. You know, you had a much more homogenous population that the liberation movement was able to unify in a national liberation struggle and defeat the Americans. Well, you know, first the French and then the Americans. So it's very different time period. Globalization has changed a lot of things. So,
and how do you perceive the decolonization for non-indigenous people, or the necessity of decolonization for non-indigenous people?
Yeah, I do think it's very necessary, because non-indigenous people too have been colonized in one way or another. I mean, if you're looking at European settlers who are here in North America, well, their ancestors were colonized maybe 2,000 years ago, maybe 1,500 years ago by the Romans, who colonized most of Western Europe and established Western civilization, Christianity, feudalism, capitalism, imperialism. So everybody has some need to decolonize. And the thing about indigenous peoples is, like, all people in the world were at one time indigenous tribal people. That's just how everybody lived. And it was only with the establishment and the expansion of civilizations, which are always kind of imperially based, that's when you had colonization going on in different parts of the world, wherever you had large civilizations established. So everybody kind of has a need to decolonize from this capitalist industrial system. And I think that's kind of what we're going towards anyway, because the system can only maintain itself for so long. And in order for people to survive, you're going to have to build community. That's a form of decolonization, because colonization, as we've experienced it here in North America and in Western Europe, you know, it wants to break down the society, break down the nations, the tribal nations, break down the communities, and break down the families, so that you have isolated individual units running around, and they're all kind of independent, but they're totally dependent on the system. So in that way too, we all kind of need to decolonize.
And how can we build the alliance between non-indigenous and indigenous in that sense?
You know, I always promote anti-colonial and anti-capitalist resistance, because here, like, you have different kind of social forces, and one of them is the indigenous people, and they're a very strong social force, because this is their traditional territories here in North America. And that's like a basic contradiction of the system here. Like, it claims to be, it's all based on law and order, it's all just and all that. Like Canada, you know, it's a democracy, all this kind of like mythology about the nation state here. But the basic contradiction of it is that it's a nation state that's only existed because of the genocide of indigenous peoples and the theft of indigenous lands. So that's like a basic contradiction that any social movement that wants to talk about anti-capitalist resistance has to take into account. And in the same way, like, an anti-colonial movement has to incorporate anti-capitalist resistance into it. Otherwise, it's just so easily co-opted. Indigenous people, for example, just trying to get a bigger slice of the pie without dealing with the capitalist destruction that's being inflicted on the land and the water and the people as well. So, I mean, it's necessary to build alliances, because not one of these social forces by itself can build that power to overthrow or dismantle the system. So we all need each other. People, we all need each other as people. And all the people who have really nothing to gain from this system, they have much more to gain by building alliances together and working towards a common goal, which is, you know, the liberation from this capitalist, colonial, imperialist system. So it's in our interest to build alliances with everybody, as many people as possible, as many social groups as possible.
And also, you've been talking about a lot on your writings about the structures of the Indian Act and how they play the role of colonization, like imposed by the Canadian government, like the Bank Council system and the EFN, and how they are playing the role of also colonization people because, with indigenous faces.
Well, the Band Councils and the Assembly of First Nations and all these political organizations that are basically were either established and or funded by the government, I mean, they do this for a reason, and that's to control indigenous people. And they're basically collaborators with the state and capital. But they are the agents of neocolonialism. And that's what the 1950s period of decolonization, that's what one thing we can learn from that is, like, when you have an anti-colonial liberation movement that arises and that is successful in gaining concessions or reforms from the state, the danger is that it just becomes neocolonialism, where instead of the white governor, then you have a brown governor. And, you know, that's what the Assembly of First Nations and the Band Councils, that's the role they would play. And in the local areas on the bands, on the reserves, that's the role that they play. They are the government administrators at the most local level. And the thing about them is, like, they present themselves as if they're fighting against the government in the interests of the people. But they have their own power struggle with the state, and they portray that as being a popular struggle of the people against the government. But they're only fighting for their own self-interest. And you can see that with the most recent Idle No More organizing, when all the Band Council chiefs were jumping on board and were rallying, helping organize a lot of the Idle No More rallies. And, you know, especially in Manitoba and Saskatchewan, in those areas, those bands and their provincial political organizations were in an intense power struggle with the federal government. And so that's part of the danger, because they confuse indigenous people and they blunt the resistance. Any grassroots organizing that occurs, they blunt it and they just instill confusion in the movement, because people think that these chiefs and councils, you know, with their fiery rhetoric, they're talking all militant. At the end of the day, they don't do anything, but they make the people think that they're fighting for their rights and all this kind of stuff. So that's like something that always needs to be clarified within the indigenous movement about what the role of the Band Council and these political organizations such as the AFN are. It's an ongoing process, you know, it's like an ongoing educational process that needs to occur. Those anti-colonial liberation movements from the 1950s in Africa and that, the history of those movements is very important too, because you can see how the government, they did the same thing in Africa, a lot of those African countries, is they set up these fake chiefs and councils. And when the resistant movements became much stronger, of course the government used those chiefs to blunt the resistance and to betray it and all that. Some of those chiefs, of course, they did side with the liberation movement. And, you know, that's another example of, like, dividing the enemy and, you know, making alliances and getting resources through that. But it's a very problematic, it's a very hard process, because the chiefs come out and support a radical resistance movement. It's basically like political suicide for them. They're not going to be in office for much longer. And you can see there's many examples of that throughout, even in Canada, you know, like with different, you know, so-called political leaders who took a more confrontational tone with the government, and then the next thing you know, they lost their office of some kind. But overall, I mean, we need to identify the real role. Like, why did the government set up band councils? Why do they continue to fund all the political organizations? It's for a purpose. So that's something that's always an ongoing struggle.
Could you talk about the sources of reference, like books, readings, like websites, whatever, who can be good to learn about decolonization and struggles related with decolonization?
Oh, sure. Well, you mentioned one, France Fanon, the book Wretched of the Earth. It's a very, very good book. It's very intellectual. It can be hard to read, but if you struggle through that book, you'll come away with a lot clearer understanding of what colonialism is, of what anti-colonial resistance is, and that's why that book is so influential. That's a very good book. Another book I would recommend for people in Canada, especially maybe, is like books by Howard Adams. He was a Métis kind of revolutionary. He wrote Prison of Grass in the 1970s, and then I think in the 1990s he wrote A Tortured People, The Politics of Colonization. So those are two good books to read. Some of Ward Churchill's writings are pretty good too. Agents of Repression, which talks about the history of primarily the FBI in the United States, their counterinsurgency campaign that they waged against the Black Panther Party and the American Indian Movement. I think that's like an important understanding of what's going on today. Well, I got my 500 Years of Resistance comic book, which from Arsenal Pulp Press, which just kind of gives an overview of a lot of the highlights of anti-colonial resistance here in the Americas, like North America and South America. I would recommend that book, not just because I did it, but because it's a comic book. It's like a graphic novel, so it might be easier for people to read. And what else is there? Well, there's my website, warriorpublications.wordpress.com. A lot of my writings and that are posted on there. What else is there? There's books by Vine Deloria Jr. These are from the 1970s, 1960s. These are books that kind of inspired a lot of the Red Power movement, right? There's Custer Died for Your Sins, An Indian Manifesto, Red Earth, White Lies, Native Americans and the Myth of Scientific Fact, and Behind the Trail of Broken Treaties. Those are by Vine Deloria. He was a native writer in the United States. There's a book by Jack Forbes. He wrote Columbus and Other Cannibals, which is a good book. Donna Goodleaf, Entering the War Zone, A Mohawk Perspective on Resisting Invasions. It's about the Oka Crisis of 1990. People of the Pines by Jeffrey York. That's mostly an account of Oka 1990, but also kind of a history of the Mohawks in particular. There's Peter Mathiasen's In the Spirit of Crazy Horse, The Story of Leonard Peltier, which talks about the history of the American Indian Movement and the history of the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota, which was a very important struggle in the early 1970s. Out of that struggle, Leonard Peltier was imprisoned as a prisoner of war in the United States, still in jail to this day. Those are some books off the top of my head I would recommend for people interested in learning about colonialism and anti-colonial resistance movements.
So, thanks, eh?
Yeah, no problem.